Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Good morning, Jim and Austin. Thought we could talk about this morning a little bit about some of the stuff that's been in the press and some of the stuff that we've been reporting on Strategy Page about Israel getting more nervous about the Iranian nuclear program and what's going to happen there. I noticed that we reported over the last couple of weeks that the Israelis had finally secured the bunker busters from us.
Yes. Well, they gotten some, but now they got the big ones that had not been delivered.
And I suppose the problem
with Israel is more complicated than is reported in the news. Let me explain that without burning my sources. What rarely gets into the news, for good reason, are the growing discussions between Israel and other Arab countries, especially the Gulf states. I mean, it pops up every once in a while that, you know, Israel is talking, you know, to Saudi Arabia. And this is no secret, Jordan proves as it serves as a conduit, meeting place, whatever, because they've always been on fairly good terms with Israel for all this communication. And Jordan is basically still trying to buy back its street cred with the Gulf Arabs after years of being basically fans of Saddam Hussein. Of course, that was bought and paid for, but still, you know, still has a bad odor about it. The problem is the Gulf Arabs see Iran as their biggest threat. The problem is, for decades, they have been running this, you know, round-the-clock propaganda that Israel is the source of all of our problems. Even though they have known for many years, over a generation, that Israel is not a threat. This is all done because if you're a monarchy or a dictatorship, you need an external enemy who's really not an enemy. Somebody you can badmouth, you know, as long as you want. As violently as you want, and he won't, you know, kill you. Israel was perfect for that. They were civilized. They were neighbors. They had a beef with the Palestinians, who were fellow Arabs. They were the perfect foil. But that's backfired on them now, because Israel is now their biggest ally. If it comes down to a throwdown with Iran, either the United States is going to step in, or as these on-again, off-again rumors about Israel, you know, attacking Iran, Israel is. On top of that, Israel is the most powerful state in the Middle East. Now, Turkey is trying to hone in, no, we're the savior of the Arab, you know, states. Although, and this is another problem Turkey has that doesn't get much talked about, they can't be an enemy of Iran. They're a neighbor of Iran. They are also trying to foster good relations with that. What Turkey is basically trying to do, and Austin can comment more on this because he knows more about it, they're trying to recreate a sort of a virtual Ottoman Empire. In other words, an Ottoman Empire without all the bad parts. Just this jolly good, you know, bunch of Turks, civilized, productive, wise, sitting there in Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, willing to solve any problems you have, and basically your kindly, you know, powerful, all-knowing uncle. And that's not going down too well because basically the Arabs insist that you take sides. So this is what goes on just below the surface. The Israelis have more allies than it appears. The Arabs have more problems than they care for, and they're desperately looking for some solutions. And Israel is one of those solutions. They just can't talk about it.
Austin?
Well, let me pick up on some things I think is going on with Turkey. Turkey's got its own internal struggle right now as the Justice and Development Party, which we write about frequently, both in our Balkan section and in the Kurdish War section. The AKP, we use the acronym for it, or the abbreviation. But the Justice and Development Party is rooted in an Islamist movement, an earlier Islamist-based party in Turkey. They won the 2002 election, formed the government in 2003, and they're wrestling with the legacy of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the great Turkish leader of the post-World War I in the 20th century that set Turkey on the path to a secular democracy. So that struggle is going on inside Turkey right now, whether Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is going to undermine the democracy or and impose a Islamist rule, as many secularist Turks think he's going to do, and others who think he may be moderating his Islamism because of the necessity of being a being prime minister. And he certainly does when he goes into Arab countries to start dealing with your question now, as he did when he went to Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia in September. He said that those three Arab Spring states needed a secular democracy, and he's not a secular man, but he is prime minister of a secular state. Okay, so I'm just trying to paint the internal dimension there. Turkey hasn't got everything worked out. What it has got worked out, and it's discovered this and really began discovering it. You can go back and see some things going on in the late 80s and early 1990s. Was that knew it was in a tough region. Oh, my goodness, they had the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union on their border, communist Bulgaria when Bulgaria was communist. They had the Iranians on one border, and of course after 1979, that means you have the Khomeinists, the Islamic Revolutionary Iranians on their border, and Saddam Hussein's Iraq until 2003, and Syria and the Assad regime on their southern on their southern border along the Mediterranean. A tough neighborhood. They began to see that, wait a minute, we're economically stronger. Even though they're not exporting lots of oil and gas, Turkey's got a real economy where people actually work and they produce produce goods, and they have produced a lot of services. Their GDP now, I think they're in the top, I know they're in the top 20. I want to say it's 16th last time I looked. So suddenly, you know, they're an economic power, and they're an economic power that has, you know, as I said, it's a legitimate economy. They're not selling a cash crop. Oil is a cash crop for Saudi Arabia in this sense. And they, I said, we're going to strike out and try. Now, this was the idea behind it, especially when the AKP came in 2003. We're going to try to get along with all of our neighbors. Now, behind that, we're going to getting along with all of our neighbors is some of the what Jim says. You know, at one time we were the imperial rulers of most of what is what Arab lands, and they also controlled parts of southeastern Europe in the Balkans. So now they've set out to, I wouldn't call it a modern empire, and I think Walter Russell Mead made a lot out of this in a piece he wrote on his Via Media website 3 or 4 months ago about Turkey's big fat Ottoman idea, I think is the way he went, that the neo-Ottomanism. But it is a combination of economic influence and political influence. And they've seen the United States, in their view, waver in its resolution to stand up to Iran. They did make a diplomatic approach to the Iranians. However, in my view, and I think that if you look at what the Turks have actually done vis-a-vis Iran, they know the Iranian regime as it exists now is not their friend, their enemy. And they've seen what they tried to get along with, quote-unquote, the Assad regime, get along with him in Syria, and it's not possible. It's too unstable, and it's really an Iranian Iranian ally, and you've seen Turkey, in my view, I mean, we've written about this on the strategy page, too, really act as NATO's front man in what's a shadow war with Iran going on inside Syria. Now, the anti-Israel dimension, we touched on this in the past. Some of the rhetorical attacks by the Turkish government on the Israelis, it certainly sucked the oxygen of the Iranian tirades against the Israelis, and what it did with a number of the Arab states was it said, hey, look, here's somebody that's at least trying to, in their view, stand up to the Israelis. Dunnigan also pointed out a few minutes ago that the Israelis are the ones who are standing up to the Iranians, who are a bigger threat to the Arabs than the Israelis ever were. I think you've seen a little bit of a kind of a diplomatic dance or a political charade between the Turks and the Israelis, because if you look at some of the hard data, trade between Israel and Turkey increases. They still maintain a number of, and Jim can speak to this, important technical contacts, civil and military. And if Turkey's going around these Arab Spring states saying you need a secular democracy in the long run, that's what's not only in Turkey's interest, but it's in Israel's interest as well. So I don't really see a new Ottoman Empire. I see a country that's able to flex its own economic and political muscles, but one that, unless its government goes in the direction I do not think it is going, is one that sees the ultimate benefits of trade with other European nations. That's where they orient their trade, in a defense relationship with the United States. And one of the key things on that is the agreement to put in the anti-missile radar site in southeastern Turkey. And the Turks are right now in the process of purchasing Patriot PAC-3 anti-ballistic missile systems. And those PAC-3s are not facing Bulgaria. They face Iran. Has this made some attempt at answering your question of what they're up to? I think they're up to trying to ultimately, in the long run, and strengthen their own country, but also realize that their orientation to the West is what's made them successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, what would a strike by Israel actually look like if it happened?
Just a lot of explosions at night. And pundits, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. Apparently, a lot is known about where the Iranian facilities are. It's also known that a lot of them have been moved underground this year. It's no secret that Iran likes to build underground facilities, and they've been building a lot of them, in the last few years. The big question mark is, how much damage could an Israeli strike do? It's not like there's only one, point of impact that would cripple, the entire operation. The Iranians have dispersed it. But if the Israelis feel that Iranians, would actually, seriously consider, popping a nuke on them, they'd have no choice. But apparently that's still a debate that has not been settled. Historically, I'm sure this argument's been made, the Iranians are not that stupid. And even though they went through all this nonsense with a religious dictatorship, since the 1980s, and all this vile, propaganda, out of Ahmadinejad and many others, in the clerical, junta, as it were, that runs the place, they have not actually done stupid stuff that would invite massive retaliation. They've come close a couple of times, but they always pull back. It's known that there are factions within the government, especially the Basij, the Revolutionary Guard, the Quds Force and what have you, that are more inclined to more extreme measures. But so far they have been controlled. And again, historically, the Iranians managed to keep their wackos under control. But, if you're Israel, the downside is big for you. if the wackos do get, you know, their hands on the trigger, the nuclear trigger. You know, just think about it. You know, it's a small country and it doesn't take much of a nuclear weapon to do an enormous amount of damage. So they have a very, very real debate, going on, that has consequences. You know, nobody can say the downside doesn't exist. It's simply a question of what are the risks. And there is a downside to the airstrike. You know, the Arabs, because they are Muslims, would feel compelled to get behind Iran, but I don't think that would last too long. The Iranians would get more aggressive, which the Arabs don't like. They like their Iranians mellow. They wish they'd start drinking again. You know, they were much easier to handle before they turned them into Muslims. But, you know, they have to live with, you know, what is out there right now. And right now you have an Iran that is more and more openly trying to develop nuclear weapons, and now even the UN, who tends to be very wishy-washy on such matters. Even they're saying, you know, it looks like nukes. And when that happens, you know, one can say the fat lady has sung.
Yeah.
Dan, let me make a couple of comments about that. I've got a more malign view of the of some of the things the Iranians have done. And for one thing is I've never doubted that they intended to get a nuclear weapon. And I know Jim hasn't either. I think we first started talking about an Iranian nuke maybe 15 years ago. I mean, you know, they were at least interested in having a nuclear program. And there are genuinely millenarian apocalyptic nuts, kooks, and the junta and the mullahs, Khomeiniist junta, and they see that as a weapon that is an atomic weapon, is a usable weapon. And certainly, you can see that in the less apocalyptic frame. Sure, it does things for them nationally. Like, threaten the Saudis, threaten the Iraqis, threaten the Turks, even possibly threaten challengers to the north. It could be Russia. And there's also an interior domestic political payoff, a prestige item. But one of the things that Ahmadinejad has said, and that's, you know, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is the president of Iran, is he refers to Israel as a one-bomb state. And then you have a number of people within the junta who go around talking about that they deny the Holocaust of World War II, the Nazi Holocaust, and then come back and they say, you know, we're going to burn Israel, which is a phrase actually that Saddam Hussein used to use as well. Recall what the Israelis did in 1981, and that was the attack on the Aseraq nuclear reactor in Iraq. That act, which blew it to shreds, likely denied Saddam Hussein a nuclear weapon. I would submit that the last 30 years might have a different history vis-a-vis Iraq if Saddam Hussein had had a nuclear weapon. Now, just as a little bit of strategy page history here, going back into the old SPI roots of strategy page, Jim and I worked on a war game, Arabian Nightmare, that we put together. It was a huge design. That originally we did for ABC News Nightline. And it was a game that had multiple scenarios. And I laid out all the scenarios on this. And one of them was one that we ended up calling Beware the Ides of January, when all the actual coalition counterattack began on January 17th. So that was a damn close call. I had another scenario in there called 1994. And it was Saddam actually pulling off the attack with a nuclear bomb, a nuclear weapon, deliverable nuclear system. It made a buildup in Saudi Arabia a highly questionable, you know, the logging to put all the armor and mech forces together, increased the risk dramatically because that's a nuclear target. Same thing went through my mind, and I know the minds of American planners in 2003 with the build-up for the attack on Operation Iraqi Freedom, because you could look at Kuwait and sit there and say, you know, Kuwait's now a one-bomb state. one bond state that was slowly but surely having something like between 35% and 40% of the United States and Great Britain's ground combat power all lockered in. And I'm giving that as a kind of a rough estimate. In other words, we had a pretty good sized ground combat commitment. They could get hit with a bomb. So why wasn't it there? The Israelis took it out in 81. The Israelis see a direct connection between the actions that the Iranians are taking, and they think back to 1981, and Saddam. You know, Saddam continually miscalculated. Saddam continually would play up to the edge. Sometimes he would back down. Sometimes he'd go over it. The Israelis can't risk the Iranians making a Saddam error of judgment. And here's the, look, let's point to something that's on the page right now, which is my latest Creator Syndicate column, which was really addressing this issue. What would an attack look like? I give Strategy Page credit because Jim wrote a piece back in 2003 about a simultaneous strategic bombing strike, SSBS. Well, that's not shock and awe. If you recall that was a term used for the it could be part of a quote-unquote shock and awe campaign, but it's really a massive attack to try to knock out infrastructure. And you could, you're bringing in cruise missiles, possibly even certain types of tactical ballistic missiles. I mean, like ATACMs or similar, conceivably ICBMs with conventional warheads. Everything that can be delivered by B-2s, B-1s, and B-52s, a whole range of weapons. And the idea is you hit, and when you apply this to Iran, if there are 18 or 24 targets out there, if you don't destroy them, you damage them. Now, that's the United States that has the military assets to pull that off. The Israelis don't, unless they went nuclear. Now, would the Israelis go nuclear? Would they launch a preemptive nuclear attack? I've addressed that in the column. I say that's a terrible thought. That's frightening. Now, you can make the case, well, the Israelis threaten that so they get the United States to attack. All right. They threaten that so that NATO coalition attacks. They threaten that and they deter the Iranians. But the Iranians have made the decision, and I think this decision was made 15 years ago, and we're seeing it, if we're even recognized by the UN now, to get that bomb, and they said they're going to use it. The Israelis have to act at some point. And the question is, when does it happen? And if they don't act and they don't have the assets to do it conventionally, and that's my, that's my best guess, they don't have the conventional assets to carry off that kind of 18, 24, 30 site strike. I'm assuming that that's, this is an assumption that they've been dispersed like that. I'm talking about the nuclear weapons development, production and development infrastructure. It may be fewer targets. They may know that which critical ones, or there's a critical node, and you only have to hit one or two. That's a possibility. But if you're going to make sure you'd hit all those sites, and then you'd hit them again, and unless they've got a remarkable drone bomber system where they can have a drone bomber up over Iran consistently dropping 2,000-pound deep-penetrating JDAMs or even some fancier deep-penetrating munitions. I don't think they can do it conventionally. And if that's the case and they see their national survival, their existential, it's an existential threat posed by Iran to them, they're going to attack. And that's you don't want to see that future, but that's something you have to consider.
Now, even with the Iranians having being able to refine the uranium and like that, the delivery system is still problematic for them, right, Jim?
Well, they have the missiles, and the missiles work. Not 100%, but sufficiently if they had multiple warheads, you know, to deliver one to Israel. Another problem, which may still be stalling them, is the engineering of the warhead itself. Now, I had personal experience with this premise in the Army. These devices are not simple, and they are complex. And from what I've been able to ascertain, this has not changed. In other words, the basic laws of physics and the need for safety, are still there and still have to be addressed. Think about it. That missile is coming in at several times the speed of a speeding bullet. And that's a very hostile environment. The gravity, the heat, in some cases vibration, all that has to be dealt with. And then the mechanism must then, operate at the right moment. And a nuclear explosion, to get a nuclear explosion, you have to set off a very precise explosion of conventional explosives. It has to be precise, otherwise you get a fizzle. In other words, a dirty bomb, which is much less destructive than a true nuclear, explosion. So this is something that gets glossed over. But believe me, and you talk to professionals, and I have, this is a big engineering problem. And there's even uncertainty if India and Pakistan have overcome it. Indeed, this is one reason why they still plan to deliver a lot of their nuclear weapons by aircraft, which eliminates a lot of the hassles of building a survivable, a workable, nuclear warhead. Dropping a bomb is much less of a trauma on the device, the electromechanical device, than a missile, ballistic missile, warhead reentry. So they might have a nuclear bomb in an underground test. But that doesn't mean they have something they can deliver to Tel Aviv unless they sneak it in, by freighter.
Right. And there has been no indication that they're even close to a test at this point, right?
Well, that could change. I mean, the new UN report indicated that they had overcome a lot of engineering problems, basic engineering problems, partially due to the presence of a former Russian nuclear physicist. But apparently they have to do a lot of the engineering themselves, and they'd be getting help from countries like Korea and Pakistan, which have not solved a lot of those problems themselves. So it's the blind leading the blind. So as a practical matter, unless they get some, not divine intervention, but expert intervention from, say, Russia or China, either covert or, overt, either official or, basically smuggling, they could be 5-10 years away from a deliverable device, which is different from a workable device. A workable device, you can stick in a hole in the ground, detonate it, and say, hey, we're a nuclear power. But that's not true. You have to have a deliverable device, and that takes a lot longer.
Now, if the Israelis did launch a strike into Iran, what is Iran's current capability of resisting such a strike?
It's hard to say, because most of the Iranian military technology is smoke and mirrors. And that can be proven. I mean, we point that out periodically in strategy space. We simply, list some of the past devices, military innovations and new weapons the Iranians have announced, and then ask, well, where are they? And I've heard from people who have access to, satellite photography and what have you, and they, without giving away too many secrets, say, nobody really knows. So apparently it is mostly internal propaganda, external entertainment, when they announce all these weapons. But they have been trying to build a credible air defense system. Now, we did, between us and Israel, we did get the Russians to back off on supplying the SA-10 or the S-300 missiles, which are sort of, early model Patriot level. They could be a problem. They certainly be more than a problem than the ancient stuff, the decades-old stuff they have now, including American Hawks, which are of questionable, functionality, and even more questionable effectiveness because, there are missiles and, we know a lot about them and, we basically defeated missiles of that caliber in the past. It's always a nail biting exercise when you go up against, an air defense system for the first time because secrets are what gets you killed. Do we know about this aspect and that aspect? In other words, there's always the gotcha. If they have one aspect of their system that you were not prepared to cope with, boom, missiles get through. They don't necessarily wipe you out, but even over North Vietnam in the early 1970s, we lost B-52s. I mean, most of them, you know, made it through, but, you know, those crews, you know, felt like they were in World War II again, taking heavy losses over Germany. But in the last 30 years, United States Air Force has been very good at basically psyching out, you know, what the enemy has and countering it and taking, you know, practically zip losses. But the Iranians right now are on the losing side of that particular, you know, historical, legend. They do not have access to modern technology. They have to smuggle in whatever they can get. A lot more of it is getting caught. And as far as us in the unclassified world know, they have not put anything credible up there. So you could get through us or the Israelis, with low losses. I mean, not that there wouldn't be any losses. The Israelis, of course, would like to come back, get everybody out and back in one piece. And they plan on, you know, that, but they also plan on the Iranians having a couple surprises for them. I mean, that's only, you know, practical, you know, if you're planning an operation like this. But basically the Iranians would be toast. It's the Iranians who are in big trouble, because all the indicators are that they are not ready. And they are vulnerable, and that's why they're putting all this stuff underground. And then the big question comes as well, how can the bunker busters go deep enough? Are they effective enough? But you can do a lot of damage to the above ground. Now, what the bounce pack on this is going to be, nuclear weapons are very popular inside Iran, even among people who are very hostile to their religious dictatorship. So you're going to infuriate the Iranians. Now, what that's going to do is hard to say, because most Iranians are already officially infuriated. So, you mean, do you get up to 11 or 12, you know, on the dial? What good does that do? You might get more, suicide bomber volunteers. Well, big whoop. How do you get them into Israel? So it could slow them down, and this is the argument for the hawks in Israel, or the pessimists, depending on how you want to paint them. It would slow down the appearance of an Iranian nuclear weapon. But the real problem with Iran is its government. It's got a religious dictatorship which preaches hate and genocide. And until you get rid of that government, you're going to have a problem with or without nukes.
Right. Now, the other problem that the Israelis would face is the overflight of other territory, because they're going to have to fly over at least one or two other countries.
Jordan and Iraq, right? That problem solves itself on New Year's Eve when the agreement with the United States expires. Up until then, we basically guarantee the security of their airspace. But when they refuse to give us a status of forces agreement, you know, equal to the one we have in European and other countries, they wouldn't give us immunity to their corrupt, you know, criminal justice system. Everything, we said, okay, really, we're gone. So maybe a few minutes after midnight, you know, the Israelis will say, I mean, they have understandings with Jordan. There'll be protests. They might even be a few stray shots, but they basically get free passage over Jordan. Considering what they're doing, they should get free passage over, Saudi Arabia as well, because they are basically doing the Saudis a big solid. The Iraqis can't do anything, and basically it's in their interest that Iranian be taken down a couple of notches. Right. Iraq does not want a nuclear Iran. Nobody wants a nuclear Iran except the Iranians, which is the problem. So I don't think overflight would be a big deal. In fact, the story going around was, even while the agreement with Iraq was in play, somebody pointed out it's easier to apologize, you know, than to ask permission. So the Israelis would just go anyway, and the Americans would have to make a choice. Do we take on the Israeli Air Force? I mean, what's the gain in that? Just plead confusion and then apologize to the Iraqis. Oh, we're so sorry. And the Iraqis, looking at the smoking ruins of nuclear, you know, weapons facilities in Iran, would say, gee, okay, no harm done. And that's the situation. The Iranians are the big bullies in the neighborhood. Everybody wants to take them down. Nobody wants to do it.
Now, do the Israeli subs have any cruise missile capabilities?
Theoretically and allegedly. And the story there is that they would be used as the second strike, you know, like our boomers. Just to let the Iranians know, assuming there's one sane person left, if it's decided to try and nuke Israel, that we will get you from beyond the grave, as it were. It's mind games. But like I say, you know, historically, the Iranians aren't that stupid. And while there are more stupid Iranians running around in the government than in the past, although even that's arguable, it's debatable whether or not the stupids could get organized enough to take, you know, get their hands on the trigger. But again, if you're Israel, it's more than just a debate, an academic exercise. It's a matter of life and death.
Right.
It has no effect on us. Well, it has some effect on us, but it's not a matter of life and death to everybody outside of Israel. Indeed, it has some effect to the Arab countries because those missiles sometimes miss. And if one's carrying a nuclear weapon, you know, well, bye-bye part of Jordan or what happens to southern Lebanon. Hey, Syria, bingo. That's why most Arabs do not like the Iranians. They're powerful. They have a hell of a track record in terms of beating on their neighbors. Now they want nukes.
Yeah, and we've always got to remember that the Iranians are Persians and not Arabs.
Yeah, they have been the big bullies in the neighborhood for thousands, of several thousand years. With a track record like that, you got to be careful.
Right. Well, I think that's a good place to end it, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Yes, well,
bye, guys.
Bye.